So now we're going to move on to the roundtables, right? Am I right about that? Okay. And the roundtables will be introduced, moderated, I guess, by William Flock, who's a he's the manager of the research team of the Official Languages Support Programs branch in Heritage Canada. Language, heritage, of course, as we just heard, language and heritage are very important and very tightly interwoven. And I appreciated your also that you talked about this idea of stories. I work in James Bay, I work in Cree communities, and everything that's important is a story, is told in the form of a story. So that question of heritage, I think, is important. No matter what the form that the stories take, whether they're written, whether they're laws or stories in a sense, or whether they're told to children, heritage goes through language, because that's how we express the heritage, that's how we keep it. So I think the connection there is very, very clear. It's been doing all kinds of very interesting work in demographics and public opinion poll data, so analyzing what actually all this polling data means. So I will let him come up here and introduce the first roundtable, I guess.
Thank you, Andre. I'm just going to look to Norman for a bit of guidance, because we're a little bit behind time. How do you want to manage the blocks in the next, through the morning session? Okay. And I'm just going to mention, too, that for each of the three roundtables before us today, there will be a moderator who will kind of manage the block within the time once we get going. So I'll be sort of backing them up, I guess, say, Norman. Just as a kind of preamble to all three roundtables, the instructions given to those participating in the roundtables was not to come forward with polished, completed research, with PowerPoint showing, you know, their work, their corpus of work. It was more to really promote a kind of divergent kind of thinking, to put a lot of ideas on the table, ideas that maybe just be a glimmer, but maybe half-baked, with the understanding that this initiative over the last 7 or 8 years has come to a certain point, and probably in terms of the sort of renewal process and looking at a next possible 5 years, or you know, whatever terms it comes out, it's useful to kind of take stock and look at future directions. Would that be it, Norman? That's kind of some of the thinking there. So I think the organizers have put together three very interesting groups for us, with three different topics in each of the roundtable, a connection between them. So the three topics, just to put them in context, again, really clearly looking at the notion of linguistic barriers to healthcare. So the first one is looking at realities and myths around linguistic barriers. The second is the cultural dimensions of linguistic barriers in healthcare. And then the last one is really a little bit different, but definitely goes towards the future, looking at overcoming barriers between researchers, practitioners, and community. The first roundtable then will have four participants: Professor Norman Sigalovich, Professor of Psychology at Concordia University, who studies cognitive processes underlying second language fluency acquisition and their implications for language instruction. We all know about Norman's involvement too in the HCOM process. He's done yeoman's work over the last 7 or 8 years. Dr. Natalie Auger is a surveillance specialist and epidemiologist at the Institut National de Santé Publique and a clinical assistant professor at the University of Montreal School of Public Health in the Department of Social and Preventive Medicine. She researches perinatal epidemiology, social inequalities in health, minority populations, and neighborhood determinants of health. Professor Richard Boudis obtained a Bachelor of Science in Psychology at McGill University, so he's an alumni, and a PhD in Social Psychology at the University of Bristol in England. He's taught at McMaster University and is a full professor in psychology at UQAM since 1988. Professor Boudis published extensively in English and French on topics such as cross-cultural communication, discrimination and intergroup relations, immigration, acculturation, and language planning. And the fourth member of the first panel is Dr. G. Eric Jarvis, the director of the Cultural Consultation Service and medical director of the first episode psychosis program at the Jewish General Hospital, and an assistant professor in the Department of Psychiatry at McGill. His research activities are closely linked to his clinical work and include the assessment, treatment, and follow-up of psychosis in ethnic minority patients and the effects of cultural consultation on psychiatric assessment and treatment. So I'll invite the four members of the round table to come up, please. I think we've got, I guess we'll sort of rotate a bit. I think it'll be more efficient.
Please take your seats. So, as you heard, the purpose of these roundtables is to not so much discuss data and theories, but to have different people with different experiences of the problem of healthcare access for linguistic minorities talk about their perspectives. And we hope here to identify different kinds of barriers to healthcare access. We've already heard about the political barriers last night. We heard about cultural and linguistic barriers today from Professor Kiermaier. And our speakers at each of these roundtables are going to tell us about other kinds of barriers that we can encounter in this area. So without further ado, I'll call on Natalie, our first presenter. And you come here and I'll take the seat of the person who... Okay.
Just to show. Start? Yeah, okay. Good morning. Thank you, Norman, for inviting me. I think I'll begin just by explaining what I do. I guess it's a bit of a mystery what a surveillance means. There is a public health law in Quebec that mandates that the health minister is responsible for ongoing surveillance and reporting of the health status situation of its population. So because of this, the INSPQ, Institut National de Santé Publique du Québec, exists, and there is a surveillance team set up where I am affiliated. At the same time, we're given data that enable us to measure and determine what the characteristics are of populations where there are specific needs. So... I also have to apologize at this point. I'm having a respiratory problem, secondary to pregnancy. My respiratory rate is much higher than normal. So I'll take little breaks every now and then. Okay, so in terms of my specialization, why am I am in this? Yes. Okay, you can go ahead. Why I am in this surveillance team. I am a public health specialist, at the same time an epidemiologist and biostatistician, as well as a physician. So I'm able to look at the health status of a population from very different perspectives related to specializing with a focus on important health issues. I tend to focus on surveillance-related work because of the nature of the data that I have. So I work with live birth files, death files, tumor registries and so on, which tend to have, in Quebec, for whatever reason, language variables within them, mother tongue, language spoken at home, as well as other various health outcomes. I do take an interest in particular in perinatal health for various reasons. And I've developed a specialization in this field. My role is essentially one of a researcher, but I'm also a medical consultant within the INSPQ. Thank you. Okay, so I don't see where the slides, I'll just put this in here. Okay. I've done research in life expectancy as well as other mortality outcomes in related to suicide or some mental health issues for Anglophones and Francophones. But I've also looked at other cultural or cultural linguistic communities identified through these language variables, like the Haitian Black community that speaks Creole as a maternal mother tongue, Asian communities that speak, well, Chinese languages, Indian languages, in relation to factors such as sex selection because of a preference for sons over women, girls, at birth. I've also looked at, there was a lot of focus on indigenous health, so that is another vulnerable community that we can identify in these files that we work with. So why the question of Anglophones? Why did we begin to look at Anglophone health? And this actually began before I ever became familiar with the McGill team and other researchers interested in this issue. Essentially, for whatever multitude of factors, no one has really ever taken an interest in Anglophone, Francophone health in Quebec, but there is this emerging question because of minorities in other countries, especially in the U.S., where Blacks are known to be highly disadvantaged compared to whites, and as well in other parts of the world. So our question was, at the beginning of all this work, was what is the health status of Anglophones, and how has it evolved over time? It's well known that Anglophone health, that health can change quickly over time. Sorry, don't look at this quite yet. What we've shown is, well, we've found anyway, that there's been a convergence in health in between Anglophones and Francophones over time. Anglophones historically were much healthier than Francophones, but just gradually over 20 to 30 year period, this has narrowed and essentially converged. This is very interesting and is a very rapid change. And we were speaking about the definition of culture just a little bit earlier, that it's something that is inherited, it's kind of stable in time. So these changes over time are not necessarily only due to your culture. There's something else playing around in the whatever's going on amongst the health of these different linguistic groups that is leading to this convergence. So I will right away, I've shown you some results yesterday as well as in the past on the health status of the Francophones and Anglophones. You can find them all online. They're all published or in press. If you know how to use PubMed, you can find them there, or you can email me and I can send them to you. What I wanted to show you today, because this is very striking, this is the region of Montreal. And this work was done in conjunction with a GIS specialist at McGill, Margaret Kalakska. I hope I said her name right. And her student, Carlos Soto, who specialize in mapping. What I want you to look here at is it's just flipping between the two for a reason, between Anglophones and Francophones. And only in the most recent period, I'm not showing you what happened 20 or 30 years ago. These are rates of poor fetal growth. So red, very dark red, here, this color. You can't see it as much as on the computer screen here, but this dark red means that fetal growth problems are quite high in certain areas of Montreal. I'm not sure if you can recognize the island here. And this would be Laval up here, the northern shore, southern, south shore of Montreal. Now, when you see that it's quite orange here, now, it's a little bit orange in this area, that's the Francophones. Look at how it turns red right now. Turns red when we flipped to the Anglophones. This was not there about 20 to 30 years ago, that pattern. It has just recently emerged, where the whole of central Montreal has become an area where Anglophones are at greater risk of poor fetal growth. And when we adjust for immigration, it does not explain. There are a lot of immigrants, but just as many Francophone as there are Anglophone in Montreal, at least. So this is not this different contrast. We've got red, orange, is not explained by immigration. There is something going on, happening to the Anglophones that occurs very quickly over time that has led to this appearance of worse fetal growth amongst the Anglophones. We don't know what it is. But definitely, so is that, have you all seen that? It's good enough? Okay. I'll just close that. I'll just put my, having shown you this, plus the context of all the studies that we've done in the past, I'll just put up two questions for you. Norman asked for a few questions for you guys. Why is this taking so long? So here they are. Now, these data that I'm showing you, we can't know if it suggests that the Anglophones are becoming disadvantaged in Montreal. It's just the beginning of a possible trend for the future, or not. Maybe it's just some little blip in the data, and it'll revert back to normal in another 10 years. There'll be equality between both groups. But perhaps not. Perhaps this is the beginning of a trend in Quebec where Anglophones are becoming a vulnerable minority, a little bit like we found for the Haitians and the indigenous populations of Quebec. If so, this would be happening rapidly in front, before our eyes. And unless we measure it closely, we wouldn't know that it was there. So the questions to you then are, this first one, is Anglophone health becoming disadvantaged? To keep at the forefront of our minds. And the second one would be, if so, what to do to bring about equality between Anglophones and Francophones in Montreal? And here's where the grand debate is. At least for fetal growth and some of the other health characteristics that we can track, certain known risk factors are essentially grouped under what's called the social determinants of health. And traditionally, the healthcare system does not really fall into that. It's the environments that people live in, the factors, the social capital they in their communities, the ties they have with their other community members. Something like smoking would be very strongly associated with poor fetal growth. And infants born small live with this for the rest of their lives. However, yes. So the problem does not start while you're pregnant. It's exposures that occur to you during your lifetime that have accumulated and create conditions where your pregnancy environment is just not as healthy as it is, in this case, as it is for Francophones. And that leads to this long-lasting effect later on in your offspring. And this has happened very quickly. It's really amazing in Quebec. Now, the thing we have to be very careful about is that the healthcare system, you touch it, you interact with it at specific points in your life. Often at times when it's a bit too late to impact on these other risk factors. So the healthcare system will take care of these women that present with small for gestational age birth, or an indicator of poor fetal growth, and try to deal with the children's problems, the infant's problems afterwards. But there is much potential for impacting and preventing this problem in the first place. So that's what I'd like to leave you with. I'm not providing any solutions, I know that here, but I only have 0 seconds left. Yes, I have 0 seconds. So those are the two questions I'd like to leave you with. What is happening to the Anglophone health situation in Quebec to keep that at the forefront of our minds? And what can we do to broaden the perspective, not only focus on the healthcare system? It is an important part, but there are other aspects that we should keep in mind.
Good. Thank you very much.
Okay, you're welcome.
We have time for one or two questions, and then we'll move on to the next speaker. And then there'll be a discussion period after all three have finished. Lawrence, could you just come to the microphone, please?
There is work in the UK and some other places looking at ethnic density at different geographic levels, at local neighborhoods and so on. And I'm wondering if in looking at this, because you have this data for, you know, different regions, if it's possible to do that and if there's any relationship to local ethnic density, whether it's defined at the level of the city block or the quartier or some other kind of geographic unit.
Yes. This project, in terms of the geographic maps that I showed you, has just begun. One of its aspects will be to look at how concentration of Francophones and Anglophones versus other linguistic groups can impact the rates that we've shown. But I don't know the answer to your question. We have looked at concentration of immigrants in the past and how this was associated with preterm birth. And again, that's a touchy, hard to answer because of this healthy immigrant effect.
Maybe I didn't make it clear in my comment, just to underscore the fact that the effect in the UK and other places is that there's a beneficial effect of having the same background community around you, that it buffers things in some ways. So I think that that's you know, one way of getting at more specifically what might be going on if, in fact, there is something going on.
We intend to look at that. I don't feel positive about it because those areas where it's very red are usually very culturally connected. You know those, are familiar with those areas in Montreal.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Oh, yeah, one more question.
A quick one. You mentioned you were able to sort of look at it as immigrant, non-immigrant when you tried to sort of look at across the language groups. To what extent can you bring income data into there? You referred last night to wealthy and poor. Just one quick observation before you answer. The one indicator of sort of the socioeconomic status of Anglophone and Francophone populations, when we look across age groups, you know, five-year cohorts, there's a kind of a point at about, say, 54 and below, where in older groups, we always find that Anglophones are less likely to rely on government transfer payments as part of the general income. And then from below 55, they're more reliant on government transfer, and increasingly, as you go into the younger cohorts, a greater and greater reliance. So it suggests a kind of a socioeconomic vulnerability in younger Anglophones. And I wondered if you're able to look at it from that angle as well.
Well, the data that we have in terms of birth file, where individual socioeconomic status is known, only provides education. And this is very mysterious. Anglophones are very highly educated compared to Francophones. And it's actually not comparable. They have higher rates of university diplomas, PhDs, professional training. And so I hesitate to answer your question. The data do indicate that they are less employed. So definitely socioeconomic status has some sort of impact. It's harder to get a job when you are not as fluent in French as a typical Francophone. But the standard measurements for identifying socioeconomic status are hard to pinpoint in Anglophones. But that's an excellent question. I know many personal friends who are Anglophone and cannot find a job.